Started. Thank you all for coming. My name is Yulai Shamilenko. I'm chair of the Central Asian Studies program. And I'd like to welcome you to the last event of the Krika calendar, the Central Asian calendar. So this is the final lecture in the Central Asia lecture series for the semester. And since it's the final Krika event, we don't have any extra Krika announcements for this semester or next semester quite yet. So we'll go straight to our speaker. So I'm very pleased to introduce one of our very own, Kelly Cormier. She is a PhD candidate in development studies at the UW-Madison. She did her undergraduate work at the University of Connecticut, and she did her master's at Michigan State University. I know Kelly through the Central Asian Students Association, and she's also studied Uzbek here, and she's also worked on Kyrgyz separately. So she has, I know her in part because of her interest in the region and the linguistic work that she's done. And so she's just kind of back and about to go back from Kyrgyzstan, about to go back to Kyrgyzstan. And so she'll be telling us about her work today. And the title of her presentation is Learning to Market Fruits and Vegetables in Kyrgyzstan, a Look at Private Contracting Practices. Kelly.
Thank you, Eli. And thanks for coming. This is a bigger turnout than I expected. So, and I hope that it means we're going to have a good discussion afterwards. As you kind of mentioned, I'm back from field research. You're catching me during a six-week visit in Madison before I return to Kyrgyzstan for another 8 months of field research. And I just wanted to mention that I feel like it's really a privilege to have the chance midstream, mid data collection stage to talk with you about what I'm doing. I think that it will help me to shift gears back to the field. So thank you, and I welcome any feedback you have.
Your
cue. Oh, well, it's okay, because we don't actually need that map right now. But thank you, Kathy. Any other details that I might miss, let me know. I was actually trying to figure out how to casually lean over at a certain part in the presentation and shift to the map, so maybe I'll still have a chance to do that. This presentation is as much about what I've learned about fruit and vegetable marketing in Kyrgyzstan as it is about what farmers and processors are learning themselves right now. Today I want to share with you my observations from my first 3 months of field research. These observations are mainly gathered through several focus groups with groups of farmers and some key informant interviews. And I want to, after presenting these observations, discuss with you how they fit or don't fit the theoretical framework that I'm applying to the study of contracting in Kyrgyzstan. And what I want you to know is that I'm not going to be offering any conclusions about the evolution of contracting practices in Kyrgyzstan. That's my ultimate goal, but you'll just have to wait until I'm done with the data collection and with the analysis, and that's not going to be for a while. So please feel free to interrupt me at any time in the discussion with questions, and I'll clarify anything as we go. I wanted to start by talking a little bit about the project itself. This is a dissertation project, so it's grounded in some theory that I want you to learn about, so that we're all on the same page, we have the same language. There were two things that I wanted to accomplish with this project. First is to provide some empirical analysis on contracting practices in Kyrgyzstan, and I know from my one time at the socio-legal Brown Lab, that there are many people who are interested in empirical analysis of contracting, so I'm hoping that I can contribute to that endeavor. The second main objective of this project is to develop a conceptual framework that can be used to inform both theory and practice on the evolution of transactions and institutional change in a context of broad and rapid reforms, which characterizes many countries in the former Soviet Union, but also countries in other parts of the world. so I'd like to see what I can say about that. And now I want to briefly talk about a few of the specific theoretical concepts that that I'm thinking about as I go into the field. When I talk with farmers, some of the thoughts that are in my head, I don't always think about them all the time. Sometimes it only after I have a focus group and go back to my notes do I say, oh, yeah, that does fit or that doesn't fit. So I guess I want to first start by explaining that, in my mind, contracting fits really neatly in at the intersection of a few disciplines in social sciences, economics, sociology, and law. And because of this, I'm drawing from, when I define my framework, from the institutional economics of John R. Commons mainly, and the relational contracting theory of Ian McNeill, and some of you may be familiar with these theories. Drawing from Commons, my conceptual framework includes three elements. Some of you have heard these three before, and I'm going to be really brief. This is not the main part of the presentation, but I think it's important. Institutions, and this term is used a lot in many different disciplines, but I'm specifically referring to institutions as being working rules, which are products of negotiation that establish legal precedents, mainly. Norms and conventions that establish precedents for working within the parameters of the working rules, and property relations, which I say establish who's a buyer and who's a seller. And this is my definition of institutions. This is what I'm working within. The second main element are transactions. And you might notice that during the presentation I'm going to equate transactions and contractual arrangements, contractual practices. This is a really important element for me because I can see it in the field. I can observe transactions, and transactions reflect behavior and in turn reflect beliefs of individuals, which is my third element. And I believe that beliefs emerge from individuals working together to sort out their present, conceive the future, create the future. I choose transactions as the fundamental unit of analysis in this study because they represent the intersection between institutions and individuals. And Ian McNeill's concepts of good faith, solidarity or trust, role integrity, he makes up a lot of terms, but this essentially means a commitment to the preservation of societal roles. Mutuality or reciprocity, that's another way of saying it. And these concepts figure prominently in my examination of specifically transactions in Kyrgyz agriculture. And so when I'm talking with farmers in my focus groups and I'm asking them about their contractual practices, I'm looking for these things. I want to understand what's present in their practices. So equipped with this conceptual framework that I defended in May, right before I left for Kyrgyzstan, I set off to conduct the first part of a multi-case study on contracting practices in the fruit and agricultural, or contracting practices in the agricultural sector, specifically between fruit and vegetable growers and fruit and vegetable processing companies, with the hope that in the end I could say something about institutional change in Kyrgyzstan. And my main objectives for the summer were to finalize my selection of case sites. I already had an idea of where I wanted to work. And I also wanted to, like I said, conduct these focus groups. I didn't know how many at the time. Conduct some key informant interviews in hopes that it would unveil this range of contractual arrangements and maybe the nature of those arrangements. Because really, I didn't know exactly what was going on. I had some expectations that I would find evidence of long-term contractual relationships based on a belief that that post-decollectivization buyers and sellers were also had a role to play in Soviet period agricultural contracting. This was an assumption of mine. I didn't actually see a lot of that. I did see some of it, but it's more the exception than the rule, and we can talk a little bit more about that. And again, as I mentioned what I've observed, I want you to know that I'm still exploring this, so this shouldn't be taken as the way things are, because I'm not ready to say anything like that yet. Right, and although I wanted to mention that although my first impression was that long-term contractual relationships were fewer than shorter-term relationships, I think that this may be changing. And that's why it was a really exciting time for me to be in Kyrgyzstan. There are many donor-assisted market development projects that are specifically working with farmers and processors to link them together. Now, how effective they are remains to be seen, but this could be changing based partly on those types of activities and also on farmers and processors' own experience and on what they think is possible. I will try to get this map back. Let's see. There it is. I found the focus groups to be very informative. They taught me that there's a range of contractual practices, and I'm not talking just about written contract versus oral agreement, but vertical integration, interrupted relationships, and I'm still learning about what that means. I decided to conduct focus groups, and most of you are probably familiar with this map of Kyrgyzstan. I wanted to do a comparative study between what's happening in the north and what's happening in the south, hence the map. I want you to see where I was working. What I call the north, when I say the north, I'm referring to Issyk-Kul Oblast, which is around the big blue spot on the map, the Lake Issyk-Kul. And I'm actually, and I'm also referring to the eastern part of Chuy Oblast, which is essentially where you see Bishkek written on the map. And when I say south, I'm referring to Osh Oblast. And you might be able to pick out the Osh in the bottom of the map, and Eastern Batken Oblast. I picked these two regions for a couple of, for a few reasons. One, there are some important differences. There's a different ethnic makeup. In the north, there are many more Russians and Kyrgyz. In the south, we have Uzbek and Kyrgyz. I don't know yet what the implications of this are, but this helped me to identify these two groups. Some other differences, different marketing outlets. The northern farmers are, they have markets in the city, they have markets with processors in the region, but they're also competing with Chinese growers whose produce comes over the border, while in the south, there are city markets and processing markets, but with strong competition by Uzbek farmers. In addition, there's a different geography, and access to land is different. In the north, after privatization, farmers in general receive much more land than those farmers in the south. On average, farmers in the south are growing on 1/18 of a hectare, which is really not very much. Some of the general themes that came from the focus groups are the following, and I want to give you. I really debated about how to present the information from these focus groups. I decided to go from general to specific, so I want to give you a general overview of what farmers specifically were telling me about their experiences with contracting, and then I want to shift and tell you the story of one of the processors and their relationship with suppliers. And if I have time, I'll present another another scenario, and then following that, we'll have discussion. So these are the...
Before you start, could you tell us how you got the participants in the focus groups?
Sure.
Where they came from?
Yeah. I'd be happy to. Actually, I didn't mention this. Focus group... this method of conducting focus groups is something that I decided to do kind of at the last minute because I realized that I had extra time in the field and like I said earlier, I didn't really know what was going on. I wanted to get a better idea of what the range of process, range of contractual arrangements were, what the decision-making processes were, so that I could better prepare myself for the in-depth stage of the research. And I like this method a lot. So how do I pick the groups? When I arrived in Kyrgyzstan, I met with an acquaintance of mine who I'd known for a couple of years, and he told me when he learned that I wanted to do focus groups this summer, "What are you, crazy? This is a really busy time for farmers. You're never going to get them together. And if you do, you're going to have to pay them a lot of money." And that wasn't part of my budget, so I had to really think about this. And I almost decided not to do it because, like all of us, well, like a lot of us probably, we hate imposing. I mean, it's tough sometimes to go in and you're asking people lots of personal questions. But I decided, no, let's see what I can do. I arrived in Osh. I arrived in Osh a couple of weeks after arriving in Kyrgyzstan, spoke with a representative of RAS, SKS. It's the agricultural advisory service that is partially funded by the Swiss Agricultural Development Association, or bank, I think. I don't know. I don't think it's a bank. And he told me, yes, you can meet with farmers. In fact, we actually have groups of farmers that we're helping to create, and why don't you meet with them, and I'll help you arrange it. Now, when I first heard this, I thought, okay, well, maybe this is compromising, this some methodological protocol, because I was relying on the assistance of this this colleague of mine in designing a focus group. You want homogeneity of members. You want meaning. Age, meaning similar experiences. You also want anonymity. Well, I had homogeneity. I had a group of farmers who had some contracting experience, and they were about the same age. And actually, there were groups divided by women and men, so I had that. But I didn't have anonymity, and I decided, oh, let's just go with it. And I'm glad that I did, because honestly, I don't know how I would have done it otherwise. And I'd like to hear from you how you think this might have been problematic, but in the end, I feel like it was a really rich experience, and I find the information very useful. So, I had assistance. I was invited to... I worked with this representative to select groups. There were 12 groups in Ocean Batken, and I said, okay, that one sounds good, this one sounds good. They have this much experience. These people don't have as much experience. These have long-term relationships with the processor. These really don't. I wanted to get a little variety. And then in the north, in Issyk Kul, I was able to work with RAS and also identify farmer groups. And that's how I did it. And there were some problems. We can talk about those later, but that's how it happened. And so I did 8 focus groups, actually, conducted 8, 6 of which, 7 of which I'm actually using in an analysis, one based on my method of picking groups really turned out not to be consistent with what I wanted. But that's, I guess that's just kind of, that's what happens. There were some differences between North and South, but rather than focus on the differences, what I want to do is provide some general, a general description of some of the the experiences of farmers both in the North and South, because there are more similarities than there are differences. That's what I encountered anyway. Farmers do not trust processors. They don't. They're angry. They don't like them. They call them monopolists. They feel that processors do not care about them and don't understand the extraordinary pressures that they're under to feed their families. They, combined with this, there is a lack of commitment to commercial agreements, whether they're written or oral. And that's on both the part of the farmers and the processors. My impression is that farmers do not believe that their reputation precedes them when they're contracting with a processor. From one year to the next, it can be different. They do not perceive a threat to a breach of contract. Courts do not serve them. There are stories from processors who say, I tried to go to a court, I told them no, this is not a contracting situation, but this is an experience that leads to a belief that courts don't help you. I told them who stole my cow, and they said, we don't have time for you. So, I mean, there's no threat to breach of contract. I'll get to this later. Farmers are very tricky. So if there is an example where, let's say, there is a breach of contract, produce is not delivered on time, if at all, the processor might think, okay, well, yeah, we don't want to deal with you. But the farmers, they'll get around it by grouping together, having a representative send produce collectively to this particular processor, and that particular representative will collect payment and distribute it among all of the farmers, even those who were told would never have an opportunity to contract with the processor again. So we have lack of trust, lack of commitment to commercial agreements on both sides, a lack of information about markets, especially price. Farmers have a hard time understanding why, when the bazaar price is 15 som per kilogram, and the processor wants to charge 1.5 som per kilogram. They don't understand it, and they're very angry, and they say, how can this be? The market price is 15 som, the market price, and this is very frustrating for them. They lack information about where to get inputs. They lack information about seeds. And they describe, I found these expressions very interesting. In the South, I heard farmers talk about being in a fog. And the term that they used in the North was being in a gray cloud. Now, I don't know, for those of Kyrgyz experts, I thought it was interesting. There's this, farmers don't feel like they understand what's happening, and they don't have a lot of control about it. They feel cheated. So these are just some general impressions. I wanted to provide a quick list of some of the complaints from farmers, because I ended up hearing more complaints than not. Now, I want to preface this list of complaints by saying that I feel that during some focus groups, I provided an opportunity for farmers to complain. I was an American. I didn't present myself as an American, but I presented I'm a foreigner. And their experience with foreigners is that foreigners bring money, foreigners bring credit, foreigners bring seeds, foreigners bring wisdom. I don't know about that. But I feel like I was an outlet. I think that there was, I'm trying to assess why I got so many complaints, but I think it's because they wanted me to know that they were having a hard time. So, top of the list, transportation is too expensive. They don't have vehicles, donkey carts. Even for the farmers that are 30 kilometers away from the processor, have to rely on donkey carts. And if they have particularly ripe fruit, they will pay bus tickets so that they can get to the processor in time. But this is very expensive. Fuel is expensive. Next, the price is too low. They hate this idea, again, that the differential between the bazaar price and the processor price is so big, and they don't understand it. Their farmers told me that, well, yes, it's true. We only sell 10% of our produce when we go to the bazaar, even though they accept a much bigger price. And yes, it's true that if we do have an agreement with the processor and we do bring our product to them, and they do accept it, that in the end, we do end up making more. But it's only 1.5 som per kilogram. How can that be? They complain about inputs that are provided by processors. They're of poor quality, they say. The seeds don't produce the harvest that they're supposed to. The fertilizers aren't any good, or the inputs are too expensive. And I should go back by saying that some of the arrangements between processors and producers that are emerging now involve prepayment for future harvest or provision of inputs ahead of time. But these inputs aren't good enough. They complain that the processor closes too early in the fall. Now, this is particularly frustrating for the farmers that live farther away, because they only have time to deliver twice, while their counterparts who live 10 kilometers away from the processor can deliver 3-5 times. Not only that, they have an additional harvest. When the processor closes early, they don't have time to give their harvest to the processor. And this is a big problem. So even if there's an agreement to deliver, if the doors are closed, for example, the processor might say, we've reached our capacity, that's it, we're not taking any more. That's it. And this makes farmers very angry. The scales for weighing the produce are corrupted. They don't give the right weight. So then in retort, the processor will say, now I want you to know that I have many different scenarios in mind, north, south, when I give you these stories. The processor will say, well, bring your own scales then. But the farmers don't have their own scales. Scales are expensive. It's really frustrating. The taxes are too high. There's not enough land to be profitable, to have a profitable business, or there's not enough labor. It's very difficult when a processor is demanding small cucumbers and you don't have enough labor to gather these cucumbers in time. If you have a small amount of labor, you're going to be picking the big cucumbers because you only have enough time to gather those big cucumbers and get them to the processor. These are just some of the issues that are raised by farmers. And again, these focus groups are with farmers. In additional conversations, I was able to get the processor's perspective. Despite all these complaints, there are some advantages to contracting with processors. The processors accept less than beautiful fruit. In fact, some processors say, you know what? Take that fruit to the bazaar. We know that you can get a better price. Just give us the other stuff that you can't sell. Seems pretty reasonable. Or a processor will, as I mentioned, provide inputs such as seeds and fertilizer ahead of time. And this is something that farmers appreciate. So the range of experience is really broad. And as I mentioned, I want to focus on a specific experience because I think that will illuminate some of the challenges, and I think I only have time for one before discussion. So I wanted to talk to you about AgroQuest. I don't know, is it based on confidentiality? Can I mention names?
What deal did you cut with them?
Okay, no, not with AgroQuest.
What went wrong with the one group you rejected? Can you give an example?
Oh, yeah. This actually, yes, it was this group. I just like the picture, so I put it up. This is one of the focus groups. And this group was not...
Anonymity, huh?
Yeah. Right. I know, for those of you Kyrgyz, I'm Vara Makayev. But I won't tell you where it is. It's in the south somewhere. This group I did not include in the analysis. When I met with them, I, despite hearing that they did have experience with a processing company,
they really didn't.
And they were frustrated by that. I said, you know, we have these cherries. These are cherry trees. Then they didn't. They had tried, but they didn't. And so I decided to eliminate. I mean, still I gained some information, but it's not going to be part of the focus group analysis. But I, this just gives you a sense of how I did, where I did my focus groups. Mainly outside. I got a really bad sunburn on this day. The sun wasn't shining, and I thought I was safe, but I wasn't. It's something to remember. So, abetoplast. Let's see. Oh, okay, yeah. Switching here. This is another group that I worked with. They are included in the analysis. And this next picture, now I couldn't get a picture of the director of Agaplast, but maybe that's for the best. This is a picture of their processing facility, and you can see that they haven't really retrofitted anything probably since the Soviet period. In fact, this is a really big problem for them. They lament the fact that they don't have a Blancherovka. If they only had a Blancherovka, they'd be able to increase their capacity and meet the demands of their consumers. This processing company is really aware of what consumers want. They've tested recipes. They know they want this specific crunch. They don't like soggy cucumbers. They're frustrated with their producers because their producers are not giving them the right cucumbers. But these cucumbers apparently passed the test because they're being kept in this tank until they go through the system.
And so the absence of retrofitting goes to the absence of a financial marketplace or banks that can provide credit, that kind of thing? Is that
there are banks. There are banks that can provide credit. In fact, the main competitor for Agrodoplast, Eastman, got a huge grant, and they actually built their factory from the ground up. There is credit available, but
you said a grant.
Oh yes, actually that was
a
grant.
Was it a grant from a Western type organization or from a bank?
That grant, you're right. You know what? That grant was a USAID grant. That was a grant.
It was us.
That was a grant. Yeah, it was us.
So they can
crunchy pickles. Well, actually, their factory is so huge that they're not able to meet their capacity. So it's a bit of a problem. These are questions that I have to follow up on because I don't know. They're just making it. Agrodoplast is just making it. Uh-huh. They actually were doing better a few years ago, apparently, and they've taken a dive. I don't know what I don't understand why they've reversed their performance while another processing company in Osh, which was kind of a competitor of theirs, has just taken off. And I don't understand why that's happened. But, so I don't have a good answer for your question.
No, but that's just something to add to the analysis.
To understand, right, because clearly, well, and they complain about it. They want new equipment. So Agrapas, they're in southwestern Kyrgyzstan in Kizilkia. And I think they're an interesting case because this processing company is one of two processors that I encountered that actually does maintain long-term relationships with some farmers. And they, by their own admission, have two groups of farmers, the privileged, they call them, and then the others. And let's see, just to give you a little bit more information about Agrapas, capacity of, well, it's hard when it's, I mean, it's not even relative because I don't have the numbers on others, but 6.5 million cans of conserves a year, mainly tomato paste, pickled cucumbers, marinated vegetable salads. I'm sure that you know what I'm talking about. Fruit juices, jam, and stewed fruits. So it's a large, it's a diversified company, we'll say. When I spoke with employers of this processing enterprise, I think I mentioned this, they were frustrated by the quality of cucumbers they were getting, their suppliers were missing their delivery times, and They estimated about $12,500, or the equivalent of, in unpaid debt from farmers. But nevertheless, they do have some good relationships with farmers. This privileged group...
What do the farmers owe them money for?
What do they owe them money for? Well, AgriPlus keeps very strict accounting of all of the inputs and... and prepayment, seeds, fertilizers, and they expect that they will be repaid at harvest time. But if the delivery doesn't come through, or if it's not what they had expected, they don't recoup the amount that they gave out. And AgriPlus keeps a tally. So.
Is there a common problem of farmers taking inputs from one processor and then selling to them?
Oh, gosh, it's a big problem. And actually, it's not just that, too. I mean, the inputs will be used. So the inputs, for example, AgriPlus will give seeds. Seeds specifically so that they can get the type of cucumbers that they want. The Dutch are doing really well, I think, in Kyrgyzstan, because it's all, they like Dutch seeds. But, they'll get seeds and fertilizers specifically for cucumbers. But of course, these farmers often they'll grow cucumbers, eggplant, tomatoes, and they'll of course stretch it out. You know, they'll stretch out the fertilizer. They might sell some of the seeds. It is a problem, and oftentimes they'll take the inputs, take the seeds. Take the fertilizer. Maybe they use the fertilizer only for those cucumbers that they promised that they would use them for. But then it gets time to sell the produce in market. And the price is so good that they can't resist. And they'll take this product that was supposed to be reserved for the processor and they'll sell it on the market.
So what you're describing is sort of a series of holdups that are almost sort of like classic examples when we're trying to have contracts. And I guess the sort of empirical prediction that many of those models provide is that in this sort of environment, there would be strong incentives to have some sort of vertical integration in order to get around these contract problems. So do you see that at all? The processors are getting into the business of farming themselves.
Yeah, I do see that. There are a couple of examples that come to mind, and then I want to address your point about holdups. Agroplast, actually, they indicated in an interview that they were interested in vertically integrating. Enough. They've had enough with these farmers, and they want to control the production, which is something that economists argue. In the United States, we see that happening, and there are real benefits to that for an enterprise, and it's something to explore. Now, the problem in Osh, in Botken, where AgriPlus is located, is that there's very little land. So, if they wanted to own the production, they would have to buy land from farmers, but. Farmers, as I mentioned, they have on average of 12 sotki, or it's like a 1/80th of a hectare. I mean, so they would have to negotiate these transactions with all of the farmers. And my guess is that they will have a hard time convincing farmers to sell their land. Now, if there was another arrangement whereby, arrangement of in the literature, tenant farming or contract farming. I mean, that's another way to go. I don't know how it would work in this situation. That's something to explore. My feeling is that land being the only source of collateral that these farmers have, and the fact that they're living on these small pieces of land and growing on these pieces of land, and they're disparate. I wonder if that's possible, but it's something that theoretically it is a solution.
Mm-hmm. So, a quick follow-up question. So it seems like in principle, the degree to which there are to which these holdups are a problem, with rigorous incentives to try to get around these problems through whatever mechanism, is going to depend at least to some extent on physical characteristics of the crops. So where the crops spoil more quickly, for example, it seems like the processor would have a greater incentive to act opportunistically when they've got growers sitting there at the processor gates with tomatoes and they took the bus in and it was too hard to, you know, to go down the road to the next processor. It would just take too long and those tomatoes would spoil before they did that. Whereas maybe cucumbers last a little bit longer. Do you see that? Do you have enough variation in the crops that are grown to see that there are differences
Well, I'm really glad that you brought that up because one of the decisions that I had to make this summer was, do I really want to just focus on fruits and vegetables? Because the tobacco is fascinating, cotton, milk, meat, and the contracting practices do vary. I don't know, I'd like to hear from you what you think. I mean, could I really do it all? I mean, it's fascinating to me as I understand this economic transition. I do think that the inherent qualities of agricultural products lend a lot to understanding of how to solve holdup problems. Back to the holdup issue, holdups is something that I had in mind when I initially started conceptualizing this project 3 years ago. My background is agricultural economics, and I worked with the theory of transaction costs for a while, and so I thought that holdups would really figure prominently into this. But now I'm rethinking that, because I wonder, I don't know if what we're talking about here is we can call holdup in the way we talk about it in the United States. Partly because I feel like the constraints are different, the choices are different. Is there even a choice? I mean, is it a holdup if there's no choice, if it's just a matter of survival? I don't know.
Take, for example, the case of the farmer who doesn't deliver his crop to a processor to provide the input. So that seems like a classic holdup sort of problem, that there's a contract that then isn't, that is breached, that one of the parties to the contract does what's in their best interest as opposed. And so then the implication, sort of classic implication in your case, I assume, is that ex ante, there's then less incentive for the other party to invest in the relationship. So in particular, the processor to provide the interest to begin with. If the processor can't trust the farmer to deliver the product to them in the autumn, then they're less likely to provide the seed this week.
Yeah, and I mean, there is an example of that. Agroplast has said that they won't continue their relate. They won't provide inputs to those processors that have not followed through on their agreements.
But then you said that people find ways around it.
But they find ways around it. For example, let's see. I want to show you this. I'm going right to the farmer who told me this story. So, let's see. Okay, this is another focus group. I love the expression of the participant on the left. he's not, I think he's enjoying himself, but there is a situation of this. So I mean, this, so when Agroplast says we're not gonna contract with you, there was this holdup. We've lost any trust if we ever had it to begin with, and your reputation is bad, and therefore we don't, this is it. We're not going to continue this relationship. But for example, this farmer who's gesticulating, he was explaining to me that he has a relationship with the director, and he was able, in a conversation, the processor said, well, listen, I need this many cucumbers. Talk to your neighbors and give me what you have. And so he went back, coordinated delivery with all of these farmers, including the ones that AgriPlas said they would not want to contract with, gathered everything. This guy went back, sold his cucumbers, got the money, and distributed it. But, I mean, in terms of incentives, yeah. I mean, it's tricky.
What's the workaround for the lack of inputs, though? I mean, that's on the other end of it. How do they get the seed if they don't get it from the processor? There are other seed sellers they can get it from on credit, or?
They can purchase them in the bazaar, but the seeds in the bazaar are considered to be of the poorest quality. Mm-hmm. Now, there are certain, there's a lot of donor activity going on in OSH, and I think part of my study, which I didn't intend to happen, is I'm going to be evaluating this, the effect of these activities. There was what coincided with my project, and I am getting to your question, what coincided with my project, I mean, I was so excited, I really feel like I was there at the right time, because I met somebody from the from Helvetus Local Market Development Project. It's funded by Swiss Ag Development Agency, and he was just starting what he called a platform on fruit and vegetable contracting in OSH, and they met four times. I was able to attend three of the meetings, and one of the goals of this project is to bring together all of the participants along the value chain. So from input supplier to producer to processor, trader, exporter. And the reason for this is to try to build relationships among input suppliers and producers. Now, there's a debate going on right now in Kyrgyzstan among those who work with market development in rural areas. Some are saying, okay, let's have our processing companies serve extension roles. Let them pay for educational opportunities so that farmers who are lacking information on farm management, credit management, integrated pest management, they can get it, and the processors will pay for it because it's in the processor's interest, and therefore let them pay because the farmers can't. And on the other side, there's a group that says, no, you know what, that's not going to work because we can't have the processors controlling what information is provided to the producers. What we really want to do is have the input suppliers take on more control over this. So when you asked, how do they get seeds if not from the processors, right now they have two choices, either the bazaar or the, well, three, either the bazaar or our processor, or they can just save their seeds and self-provide them. But right now, and this might happen as soon as next year, they're talking about having input suppliers, those who provide seeds, fertilizers, actually work with farmers.
And so the funders are going to create these companies?
No, these companies are already created, but they just haven't established relationships. These input suppliers have like a...
So right now they sell only to processors?
They sell to processors.
So this is an information problem? That the farmers don't know about this, or that they don't interact with them, or?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. I don't know why there isn't the link between input suppliers and processors right now. Part of it, well, one of my guess is there's no real access to them unless the input suppliers come out to the villages. I mean, these farmers really are not very mobile.
Uh-huh.
So, yes?
I'm sitting here thinking about transition. Of course, we're sort of talking as if this happened yesterday. I assume that this area, in Soviet period, was organized in some way. I assume they were growing roughly the same crops, roughly the same people. What I would have sort of expected would be the Soviet people to slide over and say, now I'm a capitalist, that's a little sign up.
Mm-hmm.
And the same people run everything. Did that not happen?
It did happen in some cases. There's the director of AgriPlas actually is not one of those, but the director The director of Rahman Berdi is, and this is that processor that I was talking about that was doing really poorly for the first few years after after the transition and now has really, he's just taken off. That's him. With all of his pickled cucumbers. But he has become one of the most innovative directors that I met. And he would be one of those that you were referring to. I might have missed part of the question.
No, and he does come out of the old Soviet.
He is right out of that, yeah, yeah.
But isn't one key change the organization of property ownership? I mean, that must be a post-privatization phenomenon, these tiny little pieces of land, right? Is that how the collective forms were divided up?
Yes, that's a post-privatization phenomenon. Mm-hmm.
And somebody was asleep at the switch on that one, right?
Oh, in terms of how it was distributed?
Well, in terms of the consequences for these processors, or else mm-hmm. they didn't have the power to control it.
Oh,
or
processors were not considered, from my understanding, in this
yeah.
process of privatization. To get land into the hands of people was just, that was, yeah, that was really.
So who was running that show?
Oh, well.
Us?
We were, and, and some other informed.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, no, but it was, yeah. We helped to write the civil code and privatize land. And actually, this is an aside, but I was working on a land reform project in September and October in Kyrgyzstan, and it's there are some, yeah, the consequences of this particular method of privatization they're really extreme, and especially in Osh, think about it. You know, in 10 years, you're going to have a new generation. Children are growing up, marrying. How are you going to divide this land? It's going to be a big problem.
Who owns the processors?
Who owns the processors? They're privately owned now. he was a former director. Often, like in many collective,
he was an
processor. The Eastman processor that was built from the ground up. That was somebody that was an entrepreneur who came in and said, "I want to work in this industry." That was separate. Anvar Mikhaev.
You touch problem of mafia or criminal groups who are very influenced to the marketing possibilities of our fund?
That's a very good question. I don't think I actually saw anything happening, but I did hear some things. Agroplast, for example, not Rahman Gerdi, but Agroplast, I mentioned that they were interested in vertically integrating, and they happened to mention that they had land available to them. Now, I know that there is no land available in Osh and Batken Oblast. Potentially, this could be a mafia-related event. Otherwise, how mafia actually influenced marketing, I don't have much information on that.
Who controls the bazaars?
The mafia. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, but I don't know specifically about what's happening. Yeah, I'm trying to think. In the north, it's hard for me to say. It's too tempting to call it mafia. I don't know for sure, but the Russians who come down for the apples in Issyk-Kul, my guess is that there's something going on there, too. Do you know anything about this?
To have access to some village during the ripening of apricot,
mm-hmm.
Russian and the Kazakhstan businessmen facing problem of mafia, because mafia claim demand from this businessmen tax to access collective files. And then automatically, of course, price of apricot in Issyk-Kul down, and then they marketing in Russia or Kazakhstan.
Mm-hmm.
Price
Okay, I will have to explore this. And this is Mystic Cool, most probably, yes?
Other example.
Mm-hmm.
In Porsche Bazaar, early morning, when the farmer bring his cow to sell to steak, price of this cow about 1500 ton. No, about 1200 ton. But he cannot directly sell to consumers. First of all, from farmer, this cow bought by market. And then automatically, after a half hour or 30 minutes, price of this cow rise up to 1500 ton.
And I'm sure there are many other examples. Yeah, I'll have to take a look at that.
It is one of the big problems.
Were you anticipating problems in the future when the children proliferate and you have fragmentation of ownership of the land? You're seeing it as a coming problem?
I think it's unavoidable.
Is there right now any problem between the producers in terms of land ownership?
Yes, there are problems. Yes, there are big problems. And I wouldn't call this just a producer problem, but especially in the South, land conflict issues abound. And there are conflicts over boundaries. There are conflicts over use, what's considered good use. It's a big problem, and it is going to get worse. Adam?
Yeah, it seems to me you have a fruitful data set for a totally different kind of investigation.
What kind of investigation?
I don't know as much about the economic side, but I'm thinking there's been a lot of scholarship in the last 10 years in law and society on what's called legal consciousness, the sort of very micro-level relation of individuals to the certain legal structures. And it's been extensively studied, and largely in the United States. So we do our studies, we develop our typologies, we say this is the way people relate to authority. But of course we always read them and then say, someone needs to look at this in the country with, deeply embedded organized crime or something that really differently structures the legal system. And it sounds like your focus groups maybe have a lot of good stories of people sort of direct their mental conception of what the legal system does, how it works, and also their lived experience of that. Would that be accurate?
Yeah. The term you use, legal consciousness, I guess I haven't overtly used this term, but yeah, I am trying to understand the legal consciousness. Essentially, I'm asking, one question that I'm asking is, what role do legal rules play in contracting? And I don't know the answer to that yet. I mean, what types of are legal incentives? Do they influence behavior?
Well, one thing to think about following along that line is that there's one set of stories that you hear if you have these kind of focus groups. Mm-hmm. And when I didn't do agriculture, but I did industry, and when you would go in, I would hear these same kind of things about how the courts are useless. I went there, they wouldn't listen to me, they didn't have time for me, mm-hmm. right? And then when I went in, and that was from the guys with the pickles,
mm-hmm.
right? And then when you go and talk to their lawyers, it turns out they're in court all the time. So there can be multiple narratives within a single organization, depending on who you talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And so one idea, if you have time, might be to spend some time, at least in the courts, and to get a sense of how, they're either going to have these kind of disputes or they're not,
mm-hmm.
right? And if they're having them, then the question is, if you can get some traction on who's bringing these claims, whether it's mostly the producer side or the other side, or what's going on,
mm-hmm.
right? And at a minimum, if any of these people have a legal department, and I don't guess that the farmers would, but the pickle guys, they could have a lawyer or two to talk to them about what how they approach these problems. Because I think you might get a different story than you do around the table in the orchard.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And actually,
even a lot of lawyers down there. I guess that's
right.
Different from
yeah. the lawyers do, you know.
Yeah.
That, I mean, I don't want to push you into a whole different study, but I just want to caution you on just accepting, because I think in all of these post-Soviet countries, the knee-jerk reaction to any question about law is, well, law doesn't matter, right? And oftentimes, there's a lot more nuance that's underneath that answer than just law. I mean, it doesn't matter, but why doesn't it matter? How doesn't it matter? Yeah. You know, all that is important.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, I'm excited about going back, because I'm looking at this process of learning about contracting, learning about the legal system, learning about what works and what doesn't, practices work and don't. And I believe that experiences shape beliefs, which then lead to norms. This is part of going back to where I began. This goes back to your question on land conflicts. Land conflicts affect producers, a lot of producers. If not you, then somebody you know. And land conflicts end up in court. And a lot of lawyers are working with small, I don't like that term, but with private farmers to resolve their land disputes. Now, the reason I'm raising this is because this is an experience with the legal system, and actually there has been some talk. I spoke with some lawyers who said that their services, they're hearing more and more from farmers about contractual disputes. They're starting to hear this, but these lawyers are not prepared to deal with commercial disputes. They're specialized. They're just there to deal with land conflicts. But what I heard is that this legal system, mainly there's an arbitrage system that deals with land conflicts, is going to expand. It's going to start addressing issues of it's going to start addressing commercial disputes. I think this is really important, because if a farmer, let's say, has an experience, a positive experience of resolving a land dispute through the court system, we might be able to, you know, yeah, I mean, it's easy to think that experience would indicate that particular farmer might be interested in using the system again.
Well, also, it doesn't necessarily mean if you use the court that you really think that you're going to get your contract enforced that way. Mm-hmm. There could be all kinds of signaling going on by using the courts that means, you know, whether it's to the tax people or to, you know, other kinds of institutions as well.
Sure, you don't have to end up in the court, but it doesn't mean that the legal incentives aren't
no,
working.
But I think there could be other things going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's interesting.
It's 5:00. Let me see, is there anything?
Well, should we open it up more to questions?
Yeah, we
questions
could. Yeah, why not?
Let's make sure.
Why not?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then secondly, I must be familiar with that part of the world in my chat. I suspect there is a history of cooperative farming in that part of the world. And I suspect what is happening now is basically trying to transform to market system. And I think it would be interesting to find out as of three are going to indicate whether these groups are, these focal groups are the same members who are members of the cooperative and who are now adopting new contractual arrangements. And if that is so, how did they not yet contracts initially when they were operating as cooperative or there is a full contract, and what has changed with the new programs that are underway. And then lastly, I don't know what you think about the issue of the selection of the focus groups, if you are going to continue that method. Because one of the pictures I showed was a group of women only. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking that if I went to use that method, you might want to develop some criteria for selection of groups, sort of characterize all the groups and come up with criteria for the groups you want to end up with.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the questions. The first one on focus groups, if my notes inform me, you were asking about groups that were supported by donor, that were donor supported, and those that weren't. There were some groups that had more support than others. In the north, the level of support that the groups enjoyed really was limited to training on integrated pest management. There was no financial support. In fact, none of these groups had financial support. I mean, well, they received information from the organizations. But I take your point, and that is, take a look at, try to, if I'm going to compare across groups, it might be a good idea to identify some groups with some different experiences, or different experiences with donor organizations than others. And actually, I've thought about that too, because the hard way to do these focus groups is for me to individually identify farmers, get them to come, maybe bring them from different villages, and that would probably give me a very different set of responses. To the second question about participants as members of cooperatives, cooperatives, in the way we understand them in the U.S., for example, they never really existed in the Soviet Union. There was a series of collective and state farms, and although in some instances collective farms have been compared to cooperatives, they're really two different structures. So this idea of, I think you asked, are the focus group participants who may have been members of cooperatives, if you can maybe refresh my memory, you were asking, do they respond?
Whether they're still the same people who are now
in the groups? Okay. And I guess my answer to that would be no, because the participants in these groups, none of them were members of cooperatives per se. Some were members of collective farms. But to understand what that membership is like, it's important to know that when we think of cooperatives, we're often assuming some sort of democratic administrative structure, and that wouldn't be the case here. There wasn't, members didn't really have much say as to business decisions made within the cooperative. So I guess to answer your question, those types of participants didn't really exist in my focus groups. But when you were talking, you raised another question in my mind, and that is, I have a series of questions related to how these groups are formed, because like I said, I didn't form these groups. These are groups that have been formed, were formed by a few donor organizations that said, okay, we want to help farmers in this village, and let's say we'll take eight. They pick eight. And I still don't know how they picked them. And these are questions that I have. How did they pick these groups? Who's excluded? Who's included in this group system that provides training, that provides access to training for certain farmers? But I have a lot of questions about groups. The third question that you had about continuing this method and criteria for selecting groups, it's a good point. And if I ever use this method in the future, I will do my best to have more control over group selection. I do not plan on continuing this method at this point. Starting in January, I'm going to be beginning individual interviews, in-depth interviews with farmers, some of whom were in these groups, and then other key informants. So I plan to not continue this method.
Sort of a follow-up to that question, mm-hmm. I think, in terms of continuing relationships from the Soviet period.
do you have a sense, maybe what you're just saying is you don't, which is understandable, but do you have a sense to what extent relationships from the collective farms have carried over? My sense was elsewhere in Central Asia, you do see quite a few residues of the collective farm structure in village governance, in irrigation policy, and these different things where people are still working around the same groups of people. And is that part of what's going on in some of these?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's something that I can't answer through the focus group analysis, but it's something that I really want to understand. In Kyrgyzstan, the system of Aulak Matu, I think, is it's an important structure that emerged after collectivization. Is that right, Anvar Makayev? Aulak Matu? Aulak Matu? Aulak Matu?
After the gaining of independence.
Mm-hmm. And it's my understanding that the leaders of the Aulak Matu, these are village government, essentially, that they were often the same leaders of the rural committees before decollectivization. There were a series of rural committees.
Was main administrative and the same time proceeding unit of Soviet agricultural system.
Mm-hmm.
And the head of kolkhoz was head of proceeding company and the administrative unit.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know if, but it's some, I don't know if that answered your question, but it is something that I'm exploring. There are some although the names might have changed, there is some carryover, but I don't know exactly how it factors in.
Well, the carryover, you said there's a new civil code.
Yes.
And did we help write it, or the U.S. help write it? Well, I'm just again, you have many things. But I'd be curious as to why they thought they needed a new civil code, how it's different, what the old Soviet court system was doing. Is it at all operative? Is it that our changes made a difference in how it operates? And I mean, because there's some intersection with actual courts.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be a lot you learn that isn't getting to do with the courts. But to the extent the courts work, how much is the past hanging on to you,
mm-hmm.
onto them? I don't know how Kathy can help you.
Yeah. Well,
how you get into that?
How do you get into that? Yeah, and this is part of what I'm going to investigate when I get back in January. I mean, there's a new
survey. You were going to do a survey. Is that still in the works?
I haven't decided.
Because it would seem like if you did a survey, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not sure you're ready to do it yet, but mm-hmm. if you did a survey, then you could have more. I mean, everybody knows me, knows I'm not a great fan of surveys, but it does seem like here's a place where you could find out what is the stickiness
mm-hmm.
of these relationships, that you could get some sense of how, what percentage of their contractual relationships have existed for the past year. You really always have a dilemma in this post-Soviet context
mm-hmm.
because everybody's changing identities all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to figure out some way that if they were the ABC collective last year and they're the XYZ collective this year, but
mm-hmm.
they're really all the same people. But that's a drafting problem. But it seems to me that the criticism that you're going to get when you're finished here and you're already starting to see it
mm-hmm.
here is, okay, so that guy told you this,
mm-hmm.
but how do we know that that's representative?
Mm-hmm.
And that through a survey, but you're already beginning to formulate some hypotheses that you could explore through survey work, but you're going to get more when you do these in-depth interviews.
Yeah.
But I think that, that would allow you to get some sense of what's persisting from the past.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's an important question to ask. And actually, as I mentioned in the beginning of the presentation, I am interested in contractual practices, but I see this topic as being illustrative of this whole process of institutional change.
Right.
And so I need to understand that over time. And so I can't do that if I don't have some understanding about how the past
That's right.
influences the future. And so that,
yeah.
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 It's really we're losing the quarantine.
I know, and
I'm sure you're willing to stay around and talk to people, but maybe we should thank Kelly for a very interesting presentation.